From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Some of the things we think of as defining a traditional marriage are actually relatively recent developments, according to the new book, Marriage, A History. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the author, Stephanie Kuntz. She says even the notion that love should precede marriage is a pretty new idea. Also, Mother Antonia. 28 years ago, the divorced mother of seven left her home in Beverly Hills to live and work in one of Mexico's most notorious prisons. Although she wore a nun's habit, church rules prevented her as an older, divorced woman from joining any religious order. The church has since blessed her mission and enabled her to start a new order for older women called Servants of the 11th Hour. Mother Antonia is now about to turn 80 and is the subject of a new book. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Some of the things that we think of as defining traditional marriage are actually relatively recent innovations, according to the new book Marriage, A History, by my guest Stephanie Kuntz. In fact, she says, the idea that love should precede marriage is a relatively new development by historical standards. Kuntz also challenged our preconceptions of traditional family life in her earlier book, The Way We Never Were, American Families and the Nostalgia Trip. Kuntz is the Director of Research and Public Education at the Council on Contemporary Families and teaches history and family studies at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. You point out in your book that some of the things we talk about when we speak of traditional marriage are actually relatively recent. What are some examples of that?
Well, I think that people have this idea that couples of the past used to work harder at their marriages and be more committed to their marriages and somehow had stronger ideas of love than we have today. And in fact, what you find when you look back through history is that for thousands of years, marriage was not about love at all. People didn't work at their marriages. They worked in their marriages sometimes because marriage was really essential to farmers and craftsmen. You couldn't run a career on yourself. But for the upper classes, marriage was really more often political and economic convenience. It was the way of acquiring good in-laws, of making economic and political deals, of concluding peace treaties and making military alliances even. So the idea that you would have to work at your marriage, the expectations of satisfaction from marriage were very low through most of history.
Did people expect to be in love with their spouse?
Not at all. In fact, one of the things that surprised me in researching it is how threatening most societies through most of history, including our own, considered a love to be. It was a threat to a properly ordered marriage. In some societies, it was considered nice if love developed after marriage, but the idea that you would marry for love was something that was quite threatening.
Now, you mentioned that in the upper classes, that marriage was really about making political connections, it was about consolidating power or money. What about in the lower classes?
Well, for them too. In the middle classes in Europe, until the late 18th century, the dowry a man received on marriage was often the biggest infusion of cash or property he would get. So that was very important. And the dowry was the way that parents invested in their daughter's future. Today, we save up to send them to college. That's a get better investment. But for them, to accumulate a dowry was the way you made sure that you could get yourself a man who would, in fact, be able to support a wife or have at least some property that they could work together. Now, some historians have said that perhaps people in the lower classes were the only ones with the luxury of marrying for love, but I don't think that's true either. I mean, if you were a peasant, you wanted to marry someone whose land was adjacent to yours, somebody who had a good reputation as a worker in the community, someone who was accepted by other members of the community, because it was very important. You know, the people then relied on their neighbors much more than we do today, and neighbors really intervened in these decisions. They would, make catcalling and even pelt unwelcome suitors with stones or rotten fruit. And, of course, you also wanted... You had in-laws, having an in-law who had connections at court was very good.
People have always fallen in love. I can't imagine there was any point in human history where people didn't fall in love. And even if romantic love wasn't the basis of marriage, it didn't mean that romantic passions didn't exist. So what did people do with those romantic passions if they were mostly marrying for practical economic and political and social considerations?
That's a really good question, because for thousands of years, it was considered perfectly appropriate for men to indulge their sexual and romantic passions outside of marriage. In fact, there were some times in places such as 12th century medieval Europe where the aristocracy developed this whole theory that true love couldn't exist in marriage because marriage was for mercenary reasons. The truest love had to be an adulterous love. In other societies, there were other outlets. Many societies allowed men to have more than one wife. Only a few societies allowed women to have more than one husband. But in those societies where men married more than once, often their third or fourth wife would be their love match. You know, they would marry for practicality, and then they would marry a love wife. So there was, as you say, always love in and out of marriage. But there were very few times and places where you were expected to put all of your intimate, sensual, emotional, and romantic ideals in each other. And in fact, one thing that surprises most people is there's probably more disapproval of adultery, more support for fidelity in marriage than ever before in history today. And I think that's the other side of the fact that because you can divorce, because you can have sex outside of marriage, because marriage is for love and not for the political and economic convenience, people have higher expectations than they used to.
During a period when it was acceptable for a man to have a mistress, was it acceptable for a woman to be a mistress?
That really depended on what social strata and what country you were in. For example, in the upper classes of Europe, being a mistress was quite a respectable occupation, and your daughters and sons were married off quite well. You know, when you sort of retired from the mistress, you were kind of pensioned off. So that was respectable. At the lower levels, of course, it was not. And one of the things that's really interesting is that wives were expected to put up with their husbands' mistresses and their dalliances. I ran across a lot of cases where a woman did complain, and her own family wrote to the husband apologizing for her inappropriate behavior because it was just accepted that the wife is to shut up and put up with this. Now, there were even a few societies where women were allowed to take lovers, but that's much more rare.
At what point does love-based marriage enter the picture?
Well, of course, it's the wistful hope of young people through the ages, which is why you have love story tragedies in the ages. But it really does not become socially respectable until this very radical turning point that occurs in Western Europe and America in the late 18th century. And I think two things have to do with that. First of all, the spread of wage labor, the ability of kids to say, well, I can go get a job. I don't have to wait until my parents have a dowry. Or a young man to say, well, I'm going to go get work somewhere. I don't have to wait and make sure that my parents approve of whom I marry so that I'll get their land or their training to take over their occupation. So that was part of it. But another really important part were the new ideals of the Enlightenment and the French and the American Revolution. The idea, as the Americans put it in the Declaration of Independence, that people have a right to pursue happiness. And it was in this climate that the ideal gradually developed and spread that parents shouldn't be able to dictate to their kids who they had to marry, and people should choose their own mates, and they should do so on the basis of love, and they should give more, they should expect more in this relationship than they had traditionally done. They should put that relationship above their relations with neighbors and parents and cousins and patrons.
Was that considered a radical notion?
Oh, it was a hugely radical notion. And the people who were defenders of what was then traditional marriage, that is the arranged marriage, the marriage of convenience, were appalled. And they basically predicted a lot of the things that we seem to think of as just having developed in the last 30 years. They wrote, how are you going to stop this from unraveling? Basically, the idea that love could be the death of marriage. If husband and wife get caught up with each other and love each other too much, what will make the husband continue to exert his authority as forcefully as we want him to do so in marriage? If people get caught up thinking that marriage should be about the good of the members, what about the age-old practice of disinheriting children who were not born into a legitimate marriage. Maybe that would be wrong. If people marry for love, how will we force the people that we need to get married to get married if they don't love the person? How will we force them to stay together if the marriage becomes miserable? And what about the people we don't want to marry? Won't they demand that if they love each other, they'll have some right to marry? And you know, the French Revolution not only legalized divorce and forbade they said that one of the slogans of the French Revolution was, there are no bastards in France, that kids of your body, whether legitimate or not, should have equal rights. And the final thing they did was they decriminalized homosexual relations. They didn't quite go so far as to say gay and marriage, but they said the principle of this Enlightenment thought is that the government should not prevent people from loving each other.
Was there a fear that if marriage was based on love, then people could fall out of love, and what would happen to the marriage after that?
Absolutely, absolutely. And the earliest calls for divorce came not from radicals. Well, except I take that back. They were radicals. But the radicals of the day who were in favor of what we now think of as a conservative, traditional, love-based marriage were the ones who raised the idea of divorce, who said that if marriage should be about love and intimacy and fairness, then you shouldn't have to stay in a marriage that had lacked or lost all those qualities.
My guest is Stephanie Kuntz, author of the new book, Marriage, A History. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Stephanie Kuntz, author of the new book, Marriage, A History. You write about something in your history of marriage called the 19th century sentimental marriage. Why do you describe this as the sentimental marriage?
The sentimental marriage was the first form that the love-based marriage took. It was sort of, you know, not conspiratorial theory, but it was sort of society's and individuals' way of coping with the radical implications of the love match. And what it was based on was a much more strict segregation of the sexes than had occurred in earlier years, and much more rigid sense that men and women were completely unlike each other, that they occupied different spheres, they had different emotions, different qualities of life, and what bridged those was marriage, that women were totally without passion, that men had these strong passions, and that marriage is what brought them together. So they sentimentalized the marriage relationship. They didn't infuse it with sexuality as happened in the early 20th century.
And what happens in the early 20th century?
Well, in the early 20th century, you had a sexual revolution that was every bit as shocking to contemporaries as the sexual revolution of the 60s and 70s was later on in the century. But interestingly enough, the sexual revolution was spearheaded by people who recognized how unhappy many of these sentimental marriages were, because the sexual tensions were so great. The men, of course, to the extent that men and women lived up to the idea that no respectable woman did have sexual passion, men were often forced to seek their sexual outlets with prostitutes or mistresses. And in fact, this was so common that there was a big epidemic of venereal disease as men brought these diseases home to their wives. Women looked forward to marriage in the 19th century often with dread. They spoke in their letters to each other about, you know, the grosser sex and their worry. And also, I don't want to badmouth men here, because a lot of men really were conflicted about this. They didn't want to go use prostitutes, but they also really felt that if they treated their wife in a sexual way, they would be disrespecting her. So there was all this tension underneath the surface of Victorian marriages, and the development of sex education and of the emphasis on sexual gratification came from people who wanted to improve those love-based marriages.
So talk a little bit more about some of the changes in the early 20th century that affected how women were seen as sexual beings.
Well, there was this new emphasis then on recognizing that women did have sexual impulses. They were still made responsible for putting on the sexual brakes, so this created its own new set of tensions for women. But there was a whole new change in American courting techniques, for example, right at the end of the 19th century. The typical way that courtship was conducted, at least among the middle class, was for a man to come calling. And he would come to call on the woman, usually invited by the woman and her parents. In fact, it was considered bad etiquette for the man to say, "I'd like to be invited to call," just as later it was considered bad etiquette for a girl to drop a hint that she'd like to be invited out on a date. So courtship would take place under the watchful eyes of the parents on the front porch. And in the early 20th century, this began to change. The middle class began to adopt a technique that was pioneered by urban working class kids who had more freedom from supervision, and that was for the man and the woman to go out on a date. Now, that had its pros and its cons, especially for women. On the one hand, it meant that the woman could go away from the watchful eyes of her parents and could have maybe a better time than she would have had. She could explore her own sensual ideas. She could go have fun without being chaperoned. On the other hand, a date took place in the public sphere. It had to be paid for. Beth Bailey explains this beautifully in her book called From Front Porch to Back Seat. And she points out that the men were the ones with the money. They were the ones earning more money. If girls worked at all, they were paid much less. And so a certain amount of sexual commerce was introduced into this relationship. The guy pays for the date, and the girl wonders, how much do I owe in return for this?
Do you think that there are legislative debates about marriage today that are based on a historically inaccurate reading of marriage in the past?
Oh, very much so. I mean, I think there's a lot of magical thinking going on here, that somehow if we would just keep talking about how wonderful marriage is and should be, that we could return to a day when marriage organized everybody's life course. It was the way that people made the transition to adulthood. It organized the division of labor between men and women. It took care of all dependents, from raising children to taking care of the elderly. Part of that is just a little bit of romanticization of the past anyway. But another part of it is just misunderstanding of how much and how irreversibly marriage has changed because of the changing gender roles, the new economic independence of women, the fact that men no longer need a full-time housewife to take care of the house for them, that men and women are waiting longer to get married, so marriage no longer initiates most people into sex. And of course, if you reach 60, you now have another 2 decades to look forward to, so it's also not even going to take care of all of the dependencies at the end of life.
Are we living in the first era in which the issue of homosexual marriage was actually an issue? I mean, it was actually a possibility, something that people entertained the idea of.
Well, yes and no. There have been many other societies in history and societies and culture that, first of all, validated gay and lesbian relations, validated homosexuality. The Greeks idealized homosexuality. Plato said that love was a tremendously ennobling emotion, but he said, "I don't mean love of a man for a woman, such as the meaner sort of men feel. I mean the love of a man for another man." There have also been cultures that actually legalized same-sex marriage. But one of the interesting things is that almost invariably that marriage took place between people who, even if they were of the same biological sex, they were playing different gender roles. A man among the Native American societies or African who took on a woman's role could marry a man who kept the man's role, or vice versa for the woman. If a woman who took on a man's role could marry a woman who did the traditional female work, and in fact, that would not they didn't even have a term for homosexuality, because it would have been weird if two people of opposite sex had tried to do the same thing. You know, the gender role counted for more than the sex. So what's really new about the demands for gay and lesbian marriage today is that they are being, it's on the basis of not playing a particular gender role. And the thing that's ironic with all the people who claim that this is such a threat to heterosexual marriage is the demand for gay and lesbian marriage rode in on the coattails of the revolution that heterosexuals pioneered in marriage. It was heterosexuals who said, you don't have to have a baby to have a valid marriage. Or if you're infertile, you can find new ways to have a baby. And it was heterosexuals who finally broke with the long tradition of defining a husband as someone who does certain kind of male things and a wife who does certain kind of female things. So gays and lesbians are saying, hey, you've redefined marriage to the point now that we fit your definition, so let us in.
Now, you say in your book, Marriage, A History, that many countries around the world are facing various crises in marriage. I'm wondering if they're the same crises that Americans feel we're facing here.
Well, they take different forms, but everywhere, almost everywhere, marriage is becoming more optional, and women are gaining, especially, options outside of marriage. The age of marriage is rising in most places. The workforce participation of women and their educational attainment is rising, and that changes the traditional terms of marriage. But I really have come to believe that this is a huge international revolution, as big and unstoppable as the Industrial Revolution. Marriage has simply lost the monopoly it used to exercise over the organization of personal and social life, and we just have to cope with that. I'm not a Pollyanna about it. I think it raises some real challenges, but it also raises some opportunities, and the main thing is we need to get our heads out of the sand and deal with it.
Stephanie Kuntz, thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Stephanie Kuntz is the author of the new book, Marriage, A History. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Another bride, another June, another sunny honeymoon, another season, another reason to make whoopee.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Holy Father, Pope Benedict XVI, Pontiff for a New Era, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. Additional support for NPR comes from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, and from the Dibner Fund, encouraging the understanding of science and technology in our lives. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Mother Antonia, a divorced mother of seven who left her home in Beverly Hills to live and work in one of Mexico's most notorious prisons. She felt she was following a calling from God, but the church would not accept her as a nun because she was too old and divorced. But eventually, the church blessed her work and enabled her to start an order for older women.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Experiencing a void in her life and responding to what she believed was a calling from God, Mary Clark, a divorced mother of seven, left her suburban home in Beverly Hills, put on a nun's habit, and moved into La Mesa State Penitentiary, one of the roughest prisons in Latin America. Ever since then, she's been known as Mother Antonia and has devoted her life to helping the inmates. Her work has ranged from providing aspirin to stopping a prison riot. At a prison mass celebrating her 25th year of living in La Mesa, she was given a standing ovation from hundreds of robbers, drug traffickers, and murderers. During one of her recent trips out of the prison, she spoke to us from a studio in California. Mother Antonia, who is now approaching 80, is the subject of a new book called The Prison Angel by the Washington Post reporters Mary Jordan and Kevin Sullivan. They found her while writing their Pulitzer Prize-winning series of articles on Mexico's criminal justice system. They describe Mother Antonia as one of Rome's most unconventional servants. Mother Antonia, why, after two divorces and seven children, when you were in your early 50s, did you decide to start a new life by becoming a nun and moving into a prison?
Terry, I think that's a question everybody would like to know, and one that's very hard to answer in the sense that I was 50, and it wasn't I decided to start a new life, because for many years I had interest in the mission fields, and a particular love for Mexico, and I had visited many times the penitentiary in Tijuana, and it became a part of my life in a certain way. And in reflection, for about 2 years of a very long retreat, you might say, in reflection on my life, I knew that I wanted my life, that God called me. And a call from God is not something. It's the same as when you fall in love. You can't exactly describe why you're in love or what day you fell in love or how it was. But a time came when I knew that it was time for me to go and a step, you know, to become a being with and not just observing and being aware of, but being with those people that in particular way I was called to serve. And that was Christ in the prisoner, that I felt our Lord was a prisoner, and I felt very called to serve that Lord that was in prison, hated very often, and away from his family, and many sometimes innocent, and almost always poor. And so it was a call that came to me. It actually started many years ago in a dream, but I don't know if you'd want me to tell that. But it was a very, would you like to hear it?
Sure.
Well, it was many years ago, many years before I went to the prison, and I had a dream. It was a strange dream. And I dreamt I was at Calvary, but I didn't know who I was, because I was in the dress of that time. And a Roman guard came to me and told me I was going to be crucified, and I was horrified. I didn't know at that moment Jesus or the crucifixion or anything. I knew crucifixion was horrible, and I asked why. And there were many people there, and each one turned away when I asked why. And then I prayed that God would take me, because I was so afraid of being crucified. And a guard came back to me, a Roman guard, and told me, you don't have to pray. There's a man, and he wants to take your place. And I turned and looked into what was a cart. Maybe that comes from what I've read of French revolutionaries, executions being taken away, the people in carts. But I saw this man standing there in a white robe, and he just looked at me. And he did not look at me as if I owed him something. He did not look at me as if, look what I'm doing for you. He wants to take your place, as if he was giving without asking anything back in return. And I turned away from him, and I said, he's a man, and he's very brave, and he's willing. He's willing. And the guard came back and said, he wants you to stand by him. And I said, I can't. I can't stand violence. I couldn't stand by a man being crucified. He said, woman, he's there in your place. And so I looked back, and there was my Lord stretched out on the wood, but not nailed down to it. And I suddenly loved more than I feared. And I ran behind him and knelt down on the ground and took his face in my hands, but he didn't have a face any longer. It was blank where a face should be. and only his hair was coming down each side. His hands were stretched out. And I said, in my hands, I'll hold your face. And I thought, I'm afraid, but I'm more afraid to leave him now. I wouldn't leave him. I said, I'm not going to leave you. I'm never going to leave you, no matter what they do to me. And I stood, waited for the blow of the hammer, and I woke up. Over the years in prison, I realized sometimes in the infirmary in particular, when I first started, and there was more violence than there is now, and I would go into the infirmary, a man had been stabbed, and he was lying on the table, his hands were stretched out. And I would stand behind the doctors and the police or guards that were questioning him who did this and what happened, and I would hold his face. And I would say, look, Lord, I'm with you again. And he would say, always, no te vayas, no te vayas, don't go, don't leave me. And I would tell him, I'm not going to leave you. I'm never going to leave you. Well, that's a little background. That was the beginning of a very strong call.
You know, although you felt you were called and you knew the work you wanted to do, and you knew you wanted to be a nun, you applied to several orders, but judging from the book, it sounds like the church basically told you, you're too old, it's too late, you can't be a nun.
Well, it's not quite true today. They take women older today, a little older. But I was 50, and the age limit was 35. I particularly loved the Marinol sisters and their work. And I called, and they loved me too, but I was beyond 15 years beyond the age limit. And it wasn't for me. And I knew that if Mary Noel would not accept me, that knew me and loved me, that there wouldn't be any other order either that would accept me at that age. Perhaps a contemplative order. And I might state something to you, if you'll allow me, Terry. You said, I knew I wanted to be a nun. They'll always refer to me and other sisters as nuns. Actually, nuns are women who live in cloister in monasteries. The Carmelites are nuns. The Benedictines are nuns. The rest of us are called sisters because we're active the Carmelites and Benedictines are in their great prayer life that for all of us and you and everyone in the world. And their good works they do for the poor, but they are they're monastic orders. And so if you notice, they're called the Sisters of Our Lady of Charity, the Sisters of this or that. I just wanted you to know because I thought you might be interested.
Oh, absolutely, and I appreciate that clarification. So I should say then that you knew you wanted to be a sister and you weren't able to actually join an order in that capacity because you were too old. So what you ended up doing was becoming almost like a freelance sister? You put on a habit?
Yes, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
That's a very good way to put it, Terry. A very good way. But I was a freelance sister, but I had the same boss that the other sisters did. So I was pretty sure of that, and I was certain that if I didn't, I shouldn't be doing what I'm doing.
So you put on a habit, you went to the prison in Tijuana, where you had been doing some work already.
Yes.
And you wanted to move in there so that you could literally be with the prisoners, live with the prisoners.
Yes, be with.
What did you have to do to get permission from the authorities to do that? I mean,
well,
really,
I was
they
in
must
Mexico
have thought
with
you
were the wonderful uh-huh. Mexican people.
Mm-hmm.
And the Mexican authorities, the Mexican people they have that great gift of flexibility. Everything isn't just... You know, I don't think I could have done that at San Quentin, honestly, because many people ask me, why didn't you go to San Quentin? Why didn't you go, you know, to one of our prisons? Well, I don't really think I could knock on the door and say, could I live in here and serve the people in here? I don't believe I could. La Mesa at that time was different than it is now. I probably couldn't do it at La Mesa prison now because it's become very Americanized.
My guest is Mother Antonia. For over 25 years, she's lived in La Mesa Prison in Tijuana, caring for the inmates. There's a new book about her called The Prison Angel. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Mother Antonia. About 30 years ago, when she was about 50, she felt that she was called to give her life to Jesus Christ and the poor. She moved into a cell in a prison in Tijuana and has basically lived there ever since, working with and on behalf of the prisoners. Now there's a new book about her that's called The Prison Angel. Would you describe what the conditions were like at La Mesa State Penitentiary in Tijuana when you first got there about 30 years ago?
Well, to me, you know, there's various opinions of what the conditions were like. For me, I was overjoyed that I could be in a mission, the mission of that God called me to. And the conditions were harsh in a certain way. We were poor. And it was very, very flexible. And families moved in sometimes. And the nice thing was all babies were allowed to stay with their mothers, because a baby doesn't know if it's in a crib in a royal palace or it's on a bunk in a prison. It only knows the love of the mother. And now we're not allowed to keep babies because we haven't got a place to keep them. We may be able to one day, I hope, because that was one of the beautiful parts. The parts that were difficult in those days, it was certain that it was, there was more drugs and corruption, and it wasn't as I don't think the conditions were nearly as good as they are today.
What about routine torture and violence?
Well, they speak of routine torture. And it's very hard for me to speak of anything like that, because I have to say that I'm very loyal to the people that have been so good to me. Yes, there was torture. I can't say there was not. I think I was very, that my presence was a very positive presence, that I was a instrument of peace in this war zone. Because in wherever there's torture, and there's hate, and so it was a war zone in that sense. And I think that I could do something about it. I could stop it. Never was anyone tortured in my presence.
Did you try to talk the prison authorities out of that kind of behavior?
Oh, yes, I did.
Tell us more about what you did to intervene.
Well, you'd be surprised.
Oh, try me.
Oh, my poor comandante. I remember one I had, and I once in a while get to see him now, and he was very, very young. And I'd heard about men being beaten. And I went to the director and told the director and the sub-director, and I went to the cell and got this one man out of the cell and brought him into the infirmary, because I said, look at his body, is marked. Well, the guards were in so much trouble, they almost lost their jobs. And the comandante was very angry with me. And I said, I'm sorry. I said, but I serve Christ first. And he said, I served the vigilantes here. Three men almost lost their jobs today. Why didn't you come to me? But then I said, just give me another chance. Don't let me continue to go there. Let me continue to serve. Just don't stop me any place. And he said, he accepted that. He just motioned me away, but with the promise I'd never again tell on them. And of course, I did again. And so the second time was just too much for him. And he didn't talk to me after that. And so finally, I'd say to him, Comandante, do you love me? And he would say, no. And then Comandante, just once in a while, then I started to bring him a rose. And he didn't want to accept it. And I said, it's from St. Teresa. And so there isn't any good Mexican that wouldn't accept a rose from St. Teresa. And so he took the rose, but he didn't talk to me. So finally I got one of these little hand dolls. I forget what they call them. Kermit, a little frog that came on.
Oh, from Sesame Street? Uh-huh.
That's right. And it was a hand puppet. And I opened the door to his office, and I cried out, Comandante, Comandante. And I was pretending to cry. El Comandante no me quieres. El Comandante no me quieres. Oh, oh, oh. And I was saying that he doesn't love me. And he started to laugh. And I said, do you love me? He said, you know the answer to that. And then we became very good friends. Nobody, Terry, in my experience, can resist being prayed for and loved.
in this book, the writers describe a prison riot in which you intervened and you basically got the men to disarm. Would you tell us what the riot was about and what your response to it was?
Well, I don't do anything without praying. And people say she went in alone. Well, it depends on what you believe. If you believe the way I do, I never believed I was alone. I always called on St. Michael, and I probably had a battalion of angels with me. And I think the one that they're probably talking about in the book is where there were shots being fired. And I walked in, and I asked the director, Licenciado Jorge Duarte, who was killed, unfortunately. He was a great man. Let me go in. That's my mission. If you stop me now, you're stopping me on my mission, because I must be with those men. If I wasn't there with them in this moment of crisis, then what kind of a servant am I really? A frightened one, an unfaithful one. And so I did go in, and I walked up the stair, and the men came out from, I don't know where, they all made a circle around me. I couldn't even walk because they circled me and said, "Mother, what are you doing here?" And they shouted out, "Don't shoot, Mother's here." And they said, "Mother," and I told them outside, "People are praying for you, they're crying. Your mothers are saying rosaries, your girlfriends and your wives, your children are all frightened, and what's going on here?" When they saw me and heard me, I said, "The guns, give me the weapons right now, sons, give them to me. God is watching, God is with us, and we're going to help you. You are right to be upset. You have every right to feel upset, and I'm sorry I didn't visit you to see that you had needs, but we can take care of those things. But in the meantime, give me the guns, and I promise you, you won't be punished. I promise." And they said, "Mother, when we knew it was you, we dropped the guns out the cell." There was a window alongside these cells with bars too, but they took the guns and dropped them down to the ground. And so that all the television cameras were there, and the newsreels and this radio, and from Mexico City and from San Diego. And they were marveling, really they were marveling that, and saying I was the one that stopped the riot. I would say that love stopped it, caring about them, talking to them like they were human beings, giving them the dignity that everybody needs. Give me a chance, accept my apology, accept the apology of the authorities. Give us a chance to treat you better, please. Give us that chance. That's all they needed.
You promised these prisoners that if they dropped their guns, that they wouldn't be punished, that you'd make sure wouldn't be punished. Were you able to deliver on that promise? Were you able to convince the... How did you convince the authorities not to punish the men who...
Because I'm talking with Mexican authorities, and they understand. When they have men that are armed, and they don't want to come in against them because they don't want to shoot anybody. They don't want to kill anybody, just the way our police don't want to. They don't want a violent, violent problem involving maybe 30, 50, 300. It would build up that if they had to make the promise that they'd be treated better, that they'd be reconsidered why they were in the cells, that they'd maybe be sent back to their own cells, that they'd improve the conditions in the cells of punishment, that was a promise that they should keep because it was the righteous thing to do. So I was certain when I presented it to the officials in that way that they would accept it, and they did.
My guest is Mother Antonia. For over 25 years, she's lived in a prison in Tijuana, caring for the inmates. There's a new book about her called The Prison Angel. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mother Antonia. For the past 30 years, since about the age of 50, she's been living as a sister in a prison in Tijuana, working with the prisoners there and helping them. There's a new book about her that's called The Prison Angel. You came from, an upper-middle-class background?
Yes.
You grew up in a prosperous suburb. Where
yes.
you're living now within the prison, are there rats? Does it smell? Is it clean?
Well, there are rats, of course. There are many, many men there. It's kept clean. Yes, it's kept very clean. Today, it is kept very clean. There are people cleaning all the time. It's kept clean. It's kept clean. There's huge bins for garbage, and the food is served on trays today with men that wear prisoners that wear gloves and have hats, and they have cubrebocas over their head. I'm not uncomfortable. I'm accustomed to cold water, and it doesn't bother me. In fact, it's very refreshing to me. And I have a bathroom. I have windows to look out of. I have kittens outside my door, and I have a little bodega where I keep the things I bring in to give out to the people. I'm never alone because I'm always with the Lord and with the guards. I love the guards, too. I might mention that. And I serve them, too. They're a very important part of my work, and the police are, too.
I'm assuming that there are prisoners in La Mesa, in Tijuana, where you live, who have tried to take advantage of you, who have tried to steal from you, who have said nasty things about you, who have tried to undermine your work. And when that has happened, as I assume it has, what have you done in response to it? Because sometimes that's just a way of testing you to see,
yes,
well,
yes,
she's so compassionate, what's she
right.
going to do after I steal from her? Let's see.
Yes, well, things like that have happened occasionally. However, they've been very occasionally. However, I don't, I have a very selective mind. And maybe you notice this on this tape. I don't select to remember and take heart to anybody what they say against me. And once again, I have a model. Jesus Christ did not defend himself. If my work does not defend me, Terry, I have no defense. That's how I feel. I thought my work itself would, by the fruits you know the tree. And when you're there with a woman when she's having a baby and you're helping somebody that's been hurt and you need a bandage for somebody else or an antibiotic that somebody needs, you don't get it to gain their attention or gain their love or gain their... You do it because it's the right thing to do.
I assume that, you know, most or at least many of the prisoners who you are serving in Tijuana are guilty, that they're there because they're actually guilty and guilty of murder or rape or robbery. And a lot of people might be wondering, why do you feel called to help them as opposed to helping the people who they victimized?
Well, I'm not opposed to helping the victims either. I certainly do whenever I can. And I help to explain to prisoners, to men in prison, that I call my sons. And I'd like to state this clear. The majority of people in prison are not in prison for rape or murder or kidnapping or trafficking drugs. The majority of people there are for robo simple. They're for robbery, but not armed robbery, not bank robbery. And the root of the problem is really, whether people want to see it or not, is poverty and ignorance. Those are the two things that breed crime. And this has been proven in every single city in the world. Prejudice ignorance and poverty, three things, breed crime wherever in every city. However, to help them is to bring down the crime rate too. When they realize person after person has come to me that's changed their lives because I'm there, I always bring up the victims every single solitary day.
You've started a new order, and it's an order specifically for older women. And I'm really fascinated by this because, you know, as we were discussing, at the age of 50, when you wanted to become a sister, you couldn't because you were considered too old. And you've said that you think that, you know, you understand why younger women might not want to become sisters, but you understand why older women might be much more inclined to. And could you talk a little bit about why you wanted your order to be specifically for older women? What is it about older women that you think might be, with you think that they their lives might be more open to serving?
Well, I don't. What I felt, Terry, is that the gift, the call, that a woman at 50 did go and did serve, and there was fruit on the tree there, that there are other women out there at 50 years old that have meaning, and they've been through many things in life. They've been through almost all the experience of life, life and death, success and failure. They've been to the top of the mountain, the depths of the valley, and they have all those experiences to give to people that are crying out for understanding and kindness and mercy and compassion. And that's what I believe I had to offer to women and to men one day, and even to those who have failed. And maybe in the darkness you see the stars, and that's when, by the time you're 50, you've had experiences that have been devastating in your life if you've lived it all in the world, and you've come to new understandings, as sorrow brings you into understandings that pleasure does not. And so you're not bitter, and if you are, you shouldn't be, because there's a world out there that needs you. You don't have to necessarily be a sister, a servant of the 11th hour of St. John Hughes. You could go with some kind of Peace Corps or one of the many organizations that help people locally and worldwide. That there's so many people that need a visit, that need a hand, just a hand to hold their hand, just to look in their eyes and understand something of what they're going through, just to show them a kindness.
Mother Antonia, thank you so much for talking with us.
I'm very happy. I hope it was worthwhile, Terry.
Mother Antonia is the subject of the new book, The Prison Angel. It's written by the Washington Post reporters Mary Jordan and Kevin Sullivan, who won a Pulitzer Prize for their reporting on Mexico's criminal justice system. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The Tony Awards ceremony is Sunday evening. The musical Spamalot, based on the movie Monty Python and the Holy Grail, is nominated for 14 Tonys. On the next Fresh Air, we feature an interview with Tim Curry, one of the stars of Spamalot. He's nominated for Best Performance by a Leading Actor in a Musical. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air. But any time's forgiven, rise to